The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to the sixth episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And today the guest is Jules Garten. She has her advanced degree through the Quartermaster Sommelier, worked at a lot of the better wine restaurants in Toronto, including right now her main one is the Oxley, which is in the Yorkville area. She is the perfect sort of somm for anyone who wants to learn about wine, because that's how I met her. I always loved their list at the Oxley, and then I just started talking to her, and every time I went in, she's like, hey Matt, try this wine. What do you think about this wine? And she's the sort of person that gets you excited about it and makes you want to learn a little bit more and maybe get you out of your comfort zone of what wines you like to try. And I've said it before, I've said it again, I can't recommend that high enough. Get outside your comfort zone. You don't have to go on a 20-mile hike. You don't have to go on a spiritual journey from your comfort zone, but just take little baby steps. So we talk a lot about that as part of the podcast that is coming up in a little bit. What I want to talk about is wine bars in the city of Ottawa. I want to give a shout out to a bunch, and apologies for anyone who, you know, doesn't really know much about Ottawa, capital of Canada. I'm not sure where people are listening. Maybe there's people from all over the world, or maybe that's arrogant of me to assume that. Anyway, onwards and upwards. So I want to talk about four places and the guiding principle behind all of them. Really, the through line is all of them have really interesting wine lists. Wine lists where time, thought, attention, care, and more importantly, passion went into them. And that is so key. It's not just, oh, here's our Pinot Grigio, here's our Sauvignon Blanc, here's our two Chardonnays, you know, here's our Cab and all that kind of stuff. Like, these were places that had great lists. So you could tell that a lot of attention went into them. The food, good in all these places. And I was in Ottawa for barely 24 hours and managed to go to four different places. Some just stayed for a drink, others for a full meal. But the point is that Ottawa has a lot to offer if you're someone that wants to try wine. If you want to, you know, just go out and learn a little bit of wine, try stuff you haven't tried, and just good places. Also key, beyond the food and beyond the wine, the staff, the service. I mean, that's just as important, because if you have the person serving you, if they're not really into it, you're not going to enjoy the wine as much. They're not going to get you as excited. They're not going to recommend things. You know, they're going to be more blasé about it, and your experience is going to be hurt. Trust me, you're not going to enjoy it nearly as much. So I want to give a quick little shout out to four different places. The first, the place we started at was this French place called Soif, and it is run by Veronique Rivest. Oh, and I've totally mispronounced her last name. She's French, so that's how you can tell that I'm not going to be able to pronounce it properly, because I mangle things. But anyway, it's called Soif Bas et Vin. It's in Gatineau, not that far from downtown Ottawa. And what was great about this place, first, shout out to Gabriel, who was our server, and very attentive, knew a lot, try this, try that, really nice time. Really good rosé from Piemonte, from the Dolcetto grape, which is rare. I don't drink a lot of Piemonte rosé. A lot of flavor in it, really good. Also, an IGT from Verona. So it was a lot like what you would get from your Rapasso or your Valpolicella. But this one had a blend of Sangiovese, which really made it a lot smoother. Really good Valtellina. And for people who don't know what that is, it's like a, I don't want to say baby Barolo, but it is Nebbiolo from the northern part of Barolo. So we stayed there, cheese and meat, really good place. After that, Becta Dining and Wine. We only stayed for a drink, but I want to recommend this place because not only is it a good wine list, they had two or three different sherries by the glass, lots of different port, dessert wines, things like that. Like, you just don't see that often, especially in Canada, when there's, I think there's at least seven types of port, two different sherries, and a lot of other dessert wines to try. It was impressive. So I'd certainly recommend going there. For dinner, went to a place called Union Local 613. And here's my favorite thing. We stayed for dinner there. Great fried chicken. Had a New Zealand, North Island, Gimlet, Gravels, Bordeaux blend. But what I really appreciated was there was a drink called the Herb Tarlac. And for people who don't know, and if you're under 35, you might not know, Herb Tarlac is a character from WKRP in Cincinnati. And one of the main characters was called Herb Tarlick. So I asked the owner if I could quote the most important line in the history of that show, could I have my drink for free? And he's like, sure. So I said the line, which is, as God is my witness, I thought turkeys could fly, said by Mr. Carlson, the owner of WKRP in Cincinnati. It's the Thanksgiving Day episode. It is hilarious, and it is one of the most I've ever laughed on television. It was the first time that line was delivered after they tried to do a promotion where they threw turkeys from a helicopter for Thanksgiving, not realizing that what they were doing was bombing the good people of Cincinnati with poultry. And I did get the drink for free. Great meal. Sat at the bar. Bartender's name was Mike. He was great. And then finally ended up a place called Riviera. And the somm there, a guy named Alex. And when we went in there, it seemed a little bit your kind of high-end business dude, lady, douchebag sort of place. You know, really high ceilings, really dramatic. Like, you walked in, you go, okay, this place isn't cheap. And it wasn't. But service was great. And we got this bottle of 1999 Sauvignon for $100. That's a good price. And the wine was still fully alive. So certainly appreciated that. Alex was great. Went over a bunch of different wines. Yammered with him for a while. Try not to talk too long because, you know, he's busy. And the wine still alive. Great. A little bit oxidized, but you're going to expect that after 18 years. But plenty of still, like, I mean, it was ripe. Green apple, some spice, as I said, a little bit oxidized, but a really good acidity throughout, which is what you want from Sauvignon, which, for people who don't know, 100% Chenin Blanc from the Loire region. And this was a great wine. So within the course of barely 24 hours, managed to go to 4 very different wine bars / restaurants, each of them bringing you something different. One is your classic charcuterie. The other is, you know, fried chicken and, you know, a lot of stuff in between. So I'd fully recommend, if you go to Ottawa, check these places out. We had a good time. I assume you will as well. So going to get to the interview, as I said, with Jules Garten. By the way, a little update about what's coming up. Jay Onright from SportsCenter. Tom Eddy, one of my favorite producers from California, one of my favorite Napa cabs going, Tom Eddy. I'm going to be doing both those interviews later this week, and they'll be coming out in the next couple of weeks. So some really fun stuff to look forward to. If you want to tweet me any of your thoughts, MCause56 about the pod, if there's anything you want to hear. I will soon be doing a couple smaller episodes where it's just me yammering my own wine thoughts as well, but I figured these guests are available and I wanted to be able to talk to them. Remember, you can always get the podcast on iTunes and on Stitcher and Audio Boom. Please tell your friends, people that are getting into wine, people that might be intimidated by it, or friends of yours who are hardcore wine people, trying to do my best on this podcast to get something that will really strike a balance between hardcore wine person who's been in the business forever and the enthusiast and everyone in between. Enjoy the interview. And as I always like to say, happy hunting. It is Jules Garten, Advanced Somm with Quartermaster Sommelier, Wine Director for Broadcloth Hospitality. So you were worried about it, and I've already done 3 words. I think I've lisped 3 words already. How are you doing, Jules?
I can beat that. I'm good. How are you?
By the way, Broadcloth Hospitality. That Broadcloth, that there's some soft syllables there that are very dangerous for radio people.
I think they did that on purpose.
Yeah, that was
like, say it 3 times fast and see what happens.
I think I even mispronounced Garten, and that should not be a hard name.
No, I think you were good. I think you had that down.
At least good enough. But thank you so much for doing this. A lot I want to talk to just about your own journey, your own path, Toronto wine scene. I want to talk about Riesling, your trip to Douro, wine competition. We're not going to get to everything. So I think that the first question I always ask, and if you don't have a good answer, it's fine because it's a tough one. And not everyone has an answer to this. Did you have a moment? Was there that aha moment for you where you're like, I need to get into wine?
Oh my. I think I have like aha moments still all the time. I don't think there was ever really one aha moment that I was like, this is it. this is what I'm going to do. I think it was a lot of not knowing what I want to do, like being in hospitality from a very young age. Mm-hmm. Like most people, you get in when you're studying and you're going to school and it pays the bills. And then you finish school and you're like, oh, crap. You know, now what do I do?
Yeah.
And it was an industry that I loved. And I was able to travel all around the world and be active in this industry and, you know, work in various different countries in hospitality. And with that came like the ability, you know, I visited wine regions in Australia and in Europe and in South America. So there was always a little bit of a kind of draw there. But yeah. I remember when I eventually moved back to Toronto, this was about 2009. And then I'd kind of came back and was like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to get a job in a restaurant serving because that's what I'm comfortable with. And, you know, that's what I know how to do. And I can support myself. And it's when I chose to take a wine course at George Brown College. Mm-hmm. Because I was in the industry and it was just something that was interesting. And I didn't know really where that was going to go. And it was kind of like about 6 weeks in, something just clicked. And I was like, yeah, this is awesome. Yeah. And I had a really supportive teacher who does deserve a lot of credit, Drew Inns, because he was like, you're great at this and you need to stick with us. And so it just sort of gave me that reason and that motivation of, you know, maybe there's something with this. And
you sort of found a calling.
Oh yeah. I mean, before I started that, like the thought of, it seems so intimidating, like to be a sommelier. I was like, but I can't do that. I can't blind taste wine. I don't like, that sounds insane. There's so much to know about this.
Yeah.
It seemed like insane. So it was kind of neat to get going and just being like, no, actually I love this.
You mentioned the word intimidating, so we're going to go off board. I had sort of like a plot points for this entire interview, but for a lot of people listening, what message would you give to them about not being intimidated by the LCBO or, you know, the wine lists at restaurants? Because I find it's always that one barrier for people that want to learn more about wine is they get intimidated by it. You know, I know people I've known my whole life and they're like, yeah, I still get, even though you talk to me all the time, I still get intimidated going to the LCBO. How can, I mean, what's the best way to try to get people, you're not going to 100% get rid of it, but a way to at least lessen it?
That's such a good question. And it's something that I think people are faced with all the time. And I see it with staff, like, you know, when you're training staff and you have staff on the floor and people not wanting to push wine and maybe hesitant to sell wine because, you know, I don't know how to pronounce this word and I don't know the difference between this and I don't want to look silly.
One of the wines, there's no way I always mispronounce. We have a German Riesling and I'm going to mispronounce that.
Yeah, we can just call it German Riesling.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I think that's a big thing is people don't want to seem maybe sillier or unconfident to answer it. So it's like, it's so much easier for me to say, hey, have this beer than for me to be like, you know, so what if someone asked me the difference between these two Rieslings or these two Sauvignon Blancs or these two Chardonnays and I don't feel comfortable to answer it. And I think it holds maybe people back a little bit in trying new things as well. Like, oh, well, I know I like Pinot Grigio, so I'm going to order the Pinot Grigio. I have no idea what this Verdicchio is or this Suave is or this other Italian wine on the shelves. So I'm just going to stay away from that.
Pinot Grigio is liquid cold. It is an alcohol...
acid water.
It's an alcohol delivery system with a little lemon lime. And by that, I mean most of the stuff we get at the LCBO.
Yeah, there's obviously excellent Pinot Grigios, you know, made. But I think, you know, for most, it's that like, you know, $10 to $14 bottle of Pinot Grigio and people just, it's comfortable for them.
Yeah.
Right? It's safe.
And there's nothing wrong with it. There's a place for that, but you should be able to every now and then get out of your safe zone.
And I think what makes a good hospitality professional or a good somm working on a floor or server or anyone who's active in working in the wine industry in one respect or another, part of what you can do or what's great about what you do and doing your job well is making people feel safe and secure and comfortable with trying, like having an experience or trying something different. And there's ways of, you know, and I think it's a natural thing to some degree. It's maybe not as easily trainable, you know, because you have to feel comfortable with what you're talking about. But, you know, bringing people into the realm of trying something new. Like I always loved it when you'd come in the restaurant because I knew you enough and I knew you a little bit. So it was like, what's geeky that I have in house that Matt's going to love?
Oh, yeah.
And you will get people like that. And it's just about having that conversation. Great. So you drink Pinot Grigio. We can obviously accommodate a glass of that. Do you want to try something different?
Yeah.
You know, do you want to try something a little different, but along those lines. You know? And then that's how you kind of...
I guess it's almost like just little baby steps.
Baby steps.
You know, you sort of have to explain, okay, Burgundy, if it's red, it's Pinot. If it's Chardonnay, it's white. It's not going to say it on the bottle. That's part of the hardest thing is telling people some of it, you actually just have to do a little bit of research. Which, you know, isn't always a fun thing to do. But once someone understands that, then it's like, okay, explain to me left bank versus right bank. And then you just try to do it in the, I mean, very generalized ways without getting into, well, actually, the left bank Palmer actually has more Merlot than Cab. You know, and then you're going to lose people. By the way, I should say, once again, I always, like, the reason why whenever my favorite just people that work in the industry are the ones with excitement and energy. And every time you were there, it was great. I remember one time, like, Matt, we got this one wine. There's only one barrel of it. The winemaker is experimenting. Would you like to try it? I'm like, hell yes, I do. And, you know, it's like, and I'm like, hey, do you have Sauvignon? Like, yeah, we got this or this. I'm like, great. And
yeah.
I mean, that's one thing I always appreciated about you was just, it's not only the knowledge, but just the energy and just the willingness to take your time, you know, to try to help me out and try to, you know, expose me to wine that I never tried before.
Those are the highlights of the shift.
And it's fun. And that's a kind of the thing, you know, the message I want to get out to people is to get out of your safe zone. And it's not like, okay, you're like really acidic whites. You don't have to then get the Vidal ice wine, but you can just slowly, you know, here's the way I'll describe it. I've run a lot of marathons, and when people want to run and like, how do I do it? I can't tell them all the physics behind it, but I say, go outside and run 2 songs from your home. And then just run back. And then once you're comfortable with that, run 3 songs from your home and then come back and then make it 4. And it's the same kind of thing with wine. Okay, learn just a little bit about this area and then come back to your safe zone and then maybe try something else after that. So, I mean, I think that might be one way of doing it.
You might actually get me to run with that approach.
Really?
Like 2-song commitment?
Just 2 songs.
Like, I feel like I could do that.
Yeah. But the thing is, by doing it like that, you're getting rid of numbers. You're getting rid of kilometers or time or speed. And it's kind of the same thing with wine. It's like, okay, you like Pinot Grigio? Great. Try this wine. You don't even have to know where it's from or who the winemaker is or just what sort of, you know, if it's stainless steel or if they use a concrete egg. It's just try this. Do you like this? Okay, maybe you want to learn a little bit about this. And then and then we'll go from there.
That's my approach all the time.
Yeah.
Let me just bring you something to taste.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
Well, what is it? Let's just taste it first, and then we'll talk about it after.
Yeah. I want to try some Rieslings with you. I want you to talk about them because you recently were at a Riesling, it was a little while ago, a Riesling, I don't want to say convention, but seminar.
Yeah, I got to attend a really fun seminar led by Paul Greco, who owns Terroir Wine Bar in New York, and like is basically a Riesling junkie.
Yeah. So we have two. We've got a German from Moselle, and we've got the Featherstone Black Sheep Riesling from right here in the Niagara Peninsula.
Perfect.
And so we'll do that in a little bit. But I've gone this whole time without being able to congratulate you in person. Congratulations.
Thank you.
You got your advanced.
Thank you.
For people who don't know, the advanced is the highest level of the Quartermaster Sommelier is the master level. And there is like a couple hundred, I think, on planet Earth. There is soon to be 5 in Canada. I think there's 4 right now. And Bruce Walder was mentioning that he thinks there's a 5th.
It's a slight convoluted topic at this point in time. But there's a little back and forth happening right now.
So, yeah. The controversy. That's another day. There's a lot of people I feel sorry for there.
Me too.
But you got the advanced, which is incredibly hard. It's incredibly rare. So I wanted to talk about just what the actual tests were like. But first, when you were studying the hardest, what did those days look like?
I think anyone working in this industry has pretty long days to begin with. Working in service, working a lot of nights, longer shifts. I probably put the most work into that exam in my first year going in to do it because you're kind of going from ground zero, trying to ramp up to like 100 before you have to go in and sit. And you also really just don't know what to expect because you haven't done it before. So I had the most amount of work to do in my first year of tackling that. And I think it depends on the individual person. For me, if I've gone and I've worked a really long day, when I'm done, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not coming home and for however delicious the glass of wine I'm going to tempt myself with to study, like, my brain's done.
Yeah.
So for me, my approach was, you know, get up, setting the alarm, getting out of bed and going and putting about 3 hours a day in, and
what,
then
what
going
time is your
to
alarm,
work.
What time is your alarm set for? Would it be set for?
Not that bad. Like 8, 9 o'clock.
No, but 8, 9 o'clock, that's fine. What time did you go to bed the night before?
Yeah, probably 1 or 2 a.m.
Yeah. Exactly. So I'm just trying to get to the audience to realize when you work a long day, you know, night, and then waking up early to study. Yeah. Damn.
So you're, you know, you're kind of squeezing your study schedule in and around. And where I found I kind of went wrong a lot, and you have to learn what works for yourself. It's going to be different for every different human. So when I first kind of started, it was like I had my 2 days off a week and it would be like, I'm going to go study for 8 hours.
Yeah.
No, wrong. Fail. I'm going to go sit in a coffee shop for 8 hours, but I'm probably only going to be productive for 2 to 3 hours of that 8 hours.
And Facebook, Twitter, social media.
Oh, anything. Other work things. Email. Yeah. Like anything you can do. The distraction, the like off in La La Land. Like it's, So I over my years of studying and my years of preparing, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to get a good 2 to 3 hours out of every day. The best 2 to 3 hours are going to be the first 2 to 3 hours out of every day.
Yeah.
And there's some days too, like you'll go. And this is what I've also had to teach myself because I have this like guilt fear too, where it's like, oh my God, I should be studying today and I'm not studying today. And now I can't enjoy my day that I'm not studying because I feel like I should be studying.
You
and
should
it's
be
like,
going through flashcards
why do we do
of
this?
Rivers and
yeah,
Rioja.
I'm like, why do we do this? Like, so you also, like for me, it's also realizing there's just some days that it's just not going to work.
Yeah.
And you have to give yourself your downtime and your down days as well. And a lot of it is, there's a lot of solo work involved. Like everyone said, he's different. It's nice to be able to like, I have a couple of great people that I have met through this process living in the States. And, you know, every once in a while we'll get on Google Hangouts and do a video session and, you know, just check where everyone's at and talk theory, talk industry. But we have great tasting groups. Like I think the thing that makes it easiest is having a really great support group that you're going through. And I've been really fortunate because there's so many active people in Toronto right now that are pursuing advanced and pursuing masters. And when you have someone that you are working with and you have like that little bit of that kind of group and like mentorship and, you know, someone else to kind of push you a little bit, like you push each other.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference.
Friends, family, relationship. How much does that go on the back burner when you're studying?
Relationships? What's that? No, I'm just kidding. it doesn't. It doesn't. Like, again, you have to have balance. I'd say for sure you definitely start seeing, you see a little bit less of people.
Yeah.
You have to be a little bit more structured, right? Mm-hmm. Sundays was always try to keep your Sunday as your free day so you can go, if you need to go home and visit your fam for the day or see a friend. But I've never been super great on letting my personal life slide. Like you just need that to get through the day.
Oh yeah. But it's hard. It would be hard. Like I remember, you know, and I don't think it's as hard as the advance, but doing the diploma for WSET, you know, there were definitely times when just come home from work and it'd be hard for me because I wasn't in restaurants or surrounded by wine. So work was, you know, sports radio, the exact opposite. And then just come home and just study and just sit and study and study. And yeah, I definitely saw friends, family, relationships, saw everything, you know, took a cut because it kind of had to, because there's only 24 hours in a day.
Yeah, no, totally.
The actual, the three parts of the exam, what do you remember? Like what are your most vivid memories?
Every single detail.
Good.
No.
Good.
It's so it feels. It's like.
Well, okay, then let's go through this. Just any parts that you remember. And as you're talking, I'm gonna. By the way, what would you prefer? Start with the Moselle or the Niagara? Moselle's lighter.
I was going
to alcohol and stuff. The new world. The
you're very familiar with this one. How off dry is this?
That one's pretty dry.
Okay, so let's start with the dry, and then we'll.
Okay, we'll go to dry and go to the off dry after that. Okay, perfect, perfect. But let's first start with the theory. Do you remember any of the big questions you had to answer?
I think it's the questions that you're like, what the shit is that? Sorry, am I allowed to swear?
Yeah,
on this?
Yeah, of
okay.
Course, of
where you're just
swear.
Like, what the hell?
No, you can swear.
And I feel like those are always the ones that you just know you nailed kind of stand out, and the ones that you are like, oh my God, like, are they asking me this right now? That you're kind of like, well, those are the ones that stand out. I remember the second time I wrote it, having a question that was something about what are the subregions of Alentejo. And I mean, this is why this Portugal trip I was on recently was really helpful.
Oh my God.
The subregions of Alentejo. And I was like, Alentejo? I was like, what? In Portugal, like people that know me, we will have a chuckle about this.
Yeah.
Portugal has always been on my, I call it my like, fuck that country list.
Yeah.
Where it's like things that go to the back burner of what I'm going to study.
Yeah.
Like I'm going to spend a lot of time studying France and a lot of time studying Italy and studying America. It's the quartermaster's Americas. You know, you kind of hedge your bets on where a lot of the questions are going to lie.
Portugal is the one that's going to, is not going to get as much.
Well, and yeah, you kind of are like, okay, I'll take my chances. And so I was, you know, it almost made me feel a little bit better because I don't think I would have gone to the depths of subregions of Alentejo had I spent a lot of time studying it.
Yeah.
And the other one that I remember like vividly being like, are you kidding me? Was something like the residual sugar of dry Marsala. Like what is the maximum residual of dry Marsala? And I was like, oh, okay. I was like, we'll just throw a number down on a piece of paper.
Wow. Okay, so that's a great example.
But you spent all this time like knowing, you know, okay, I'm going to know all about Saturn, and I'm going to know all about Auchlaise, and I'm going to know all about Tokai and Quatrecharm, and like these really noteworthy kind of regions, right? And then, you know, the next thing you know, you get a question on Marsala, and you're like,
And not just about Marsala. Oh my God, that is tough. The service. Do you remember? Because service, it's their job to make it difficult and to sometimes just to be plain out mean. What do you remember from the service part?
So service, I will always say is, I think service for me personally, people look at the exam and they're like, oh yeah, service. Okay, whatever. We do this for a living. We do it all the time. No problem. This is the easy one. This is the give me of the exam, right? No one's going to say blind tasting is the give me of an advanced exam.
No.
But people will look at service like that. I think service is the most terrifying aspect of the exam. If I'm going to go in and I'm going to sit down for a blind tasting, I know that I'm going to have 3 glasses of white, 3 glasses of red, 25 minutes, and I know everything I'm expected to tell you about these wines.
Yeah.
I just have to do that.
Yeah.
Theory, you know I have an hour. I know I'm going to have 100 questions or whatever it is. There's a business of wine. But when you're standing there walking into a service exam, I don't know what they're going to ask me, right? You don't know. You know, is it going to be an Italian restaurant? Is it going to be a Spanish theme? Are they going to go French? Are they going to talk about champagne or cava or Prosecco? Like, you know, you have a sparkling wine table. You know, you have a red wine decanting table. But the thing that's so intriguing about wine is it's endless.
Yeah.
I could study every day, all day for the rest of my life and never know all there is to know about wine.
Including the subregions.
Including the subregions of Alentejo. So you're kind of like, I feel like there's so much more... like nervous energy when you're about to go into like a service scenario.
Yeah.
And that was the thing that took me out the first year. Like I didn't pass my service. And I remember everyone being like, you miss service? Like, what? Are you nuts? Like you do that every day.
Yeah.
And it was just the level of complete fear and nerves. Like I was so nervous. I couldn't probably tell anyone my name when I walked into that room because you get so worked up about it and you're like, oh my God. And you know, you're like, suddenly you forget everything you know about everything. But I would say, like for me, like the service is, it's a challenge in its own. You're doing things you know how to do on a day-to-day basis, but there's a lot of theory that comes into it.
Yeah.
You know, they're asking you a pretty high level of
questions. Do you remember any of the questions or do they have any like picky demands or anything like that? And if you don't remember, that's okay. Cause as you say,
I do. I'm just trying to think of like the experience to kind of talk about.
Yeah.
I know the first year, I also like don't want to get fired from the court for talking about the exam, but no, I don't think you can. But,
this is not Fight Club.
This is not Fight Club.
Yeah.
But yeah, the first time I wrote it, you know, you come in and you have your red wine table and you're walking around and it was quite funny because they, you know, they had ordered a house and they sort of talked a bit about the producer and you're kind of like, okay, yes, this producer, I know this producer. And then they ask kind of like a kind of cuvee from that producer and you're like, oh my God. And I'm sitting there having this moment thinking about what's the blend in this wine, like, oh my God, what's the blend in this wine? And so they start talking and they tell me what, you know, they expect done. And they'd ordered 2 bottles from 2 different vintages and given direction of how they wanted you to to go about like the service of these two different bottles. And this is what ultimately I think kind of took me out, is because I kind of was like, okay. And then I was so nervous, I literally just did not hear what was asked of me. And I did it so backwards. I think I kind of decanted the one I wasn't supposed to and did the other one and all this. And you're kind of walking around and you're so nervous. And it's so my learning take from that is like, just ask questions. Like just ask the questions to make sure you understand what's expected of you. And also that's your table.
Yeah.
I would never be intimidated of a table in my own restaurant.
No, like, of course not.
You know, it's my restaurant. I know it. It's my wine program. Yep. I know what they're looking for. I'm comfortable to look after them. So there's a little bit of a mental like headspace when you're kind of going through that. You gotta have that mentality of these people are not master sommeliers sitting in front of me. They're everyday people and they're just in my restaurant and they want to enjoy a couple bottles of wine and I'm just going to help them do that. So there's so many different levels you're operating on when you kind of go through these exams or you go through competitions or anything where it's a very, there's an important mental state of how you're doing everything. And
well, I mean, again, that movie Somm, you know, they captures it. They, you know, the first one certainly captures just the level of intensity and just the intimidation and all that goes into it. So the final part is tasting. But what I figure we'll do is I'm trying to do this with nearly everyone I interview is to go through and we'll go through two wines. We're going to go through two Rieslings because I know you're a big fan of it. I mean, everyone should be a fan of Riesling. It's,
that's fair.
And it's a stereotype I talk about on this. Everyone in the wine industry at some point, if you ever encounter a Somm or, you know, just someone who's in the wine industry at some point, they will say to you, you need to drink more Riesling. And apologies, it's just going to happen. But the first one is a St. Catharines Riesling Featherstone 2017. So their new release. I was wondering if you could, as much as you want. You can go as hardcore or as light if you were doing this for the Quartermaster Sommelier. But please don't feel like, you know, you need to nail everything. But as you see fit.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I feel like it's easy because I know what the wine is. So
yeah. Oh, no,
no,
no.
I mean,
it's another rule.
It takes away half of the...
First time on, the guest does not have to blind. Now, if you agree to come back a second time, because there's no way we're going to get to everything I want to talk about.
Yeah.
Second time, there'll be a blind portion.
Oh, bring it on.
For the interview. Yeah.
Okay. So if we're just speaking, I guess, really quickly a little bit about the visual. You know, we're dealing with white wine here. There's a little bit of light intensity of color, you know, so we'll say there's a little bit of a medium yellow, pale rim, no CO2 or sediment, anything like that showing, and a fairly low viscosity. Like it's splashy. That's how we would describe viscosity.
I like splashy. I haven't heard that one yet.
I'm trying to speak in, you know, the
terms
that people will not talk like a wine douchebag.
No, listen, on this one, you know, there's sometimes this podcast gets douchey and sometimes, you know, try to be just more, less douchey.
Yeah. On the nose, if we're talking about aromatic intensity, I'd say there's a medium plus intensity here. But it's unique in the fact that I don't find this wine on the nose super kind of fruity and floral as you might expect with, like, when you think of a typical Riesling. Mm-hmm. I find it's really like defined a lot by a little bit of that, petrol kind of, camphor notes, and then like quite tart fruit. So like tart, green apples and, underripe pears and underripe white peach and lime, like kind of taking a bit of a secondary, stance to that kind of, petrol, quality that's coming across.
Yep.
Obviously not detecting any oak on the wine either. Definitely a little bit of like a steely mineral note, on the wine. And a little bit of citrus, like a little lemon lime character.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'm going to take a swig.
Yeah, cheers.
See, that's where Riesling is so fun, because it smells like one thing on the nose, and then you go to the palate, and it's juicy, and there's so much ripe fruit, right? There's nice pear, and there's golden peach, and a little bit more of a red apple. And like acid for days, right? Like mouth is just salivating. So for sure I'm in and nothing less than high acid on this. I think it's just bridging a little bit in that off dry, camp. Like there is a slight little bit of RS, but that the acidity in the wine just pulls it back. So it, you know, it, if you're someone really like sensitive to sweet wines, I don't think this one's going to, you know, you're not going to sit there and be like, ah, it's sweet.
No, I've used this wine for a lot of events, yeah. For bridal showers, for people that want to try good wine under $20. And yeah, I always find this, even in a Muskoka party as well. So people with, you know, a little bit more affluent and yeah, most of them really seem to like this wine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice structure, like a little light in body.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably medium minus alcohol, like yeah. Maybe we're like 11 in around that camp. 11, 11.5 maybe.
Let's see. Actually lower.
Mm.
She's 10.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not like crazy depth. It's like a very pleasing, pleasant wine. There's a bunch going on, but it's not. But again, $16.95. To me, this has always been one of my sort of just go-to, just a good little grab and drink sort of wine.
You get a little bit of the honey on the palate too, which is kind of neat. Little, you know, more of that floral honey, almost a little chamomile flower coming out on the palate.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got a nice ripeness and juiciness where the fruit's concerned.
Yeah.
On the palate, more so than the nose, I would say. And a nice length. It holds its length.
Yeah. So $16.95. Definitely one that I've always been a fan of. I'll pour the other one in a second, but this is the first time I've actually done two wines. So, you know, for you, came here. You're the first one to come here. Usually I go to people's places for it. And by the way, you brought cheese.
I did bring cheese. I heard there was a Riesling and I brought cheese.
What kind of cheese? I should have cut some up when you were talking. Very rude by me.
So I've always loved cheese. Cheese is like right up there. With wine.
Is there anyone who loves wine who doesn't love cheese? Is that possible?
I feel bad for people that can't have, like, that are, like, lactose intolerant. Like, yeah. I just don't know how you just have a day-to-day. Like, it I would cry probably if they told me I couldn't eat cheese. I was running my errands and I was in the cheese shop and I was like, oh, we're going to have some Riesling. I'm going to get some cheese. Yeah. I don't know if it's necessarily, you know, the most classic of cheese pairings, but it's a Tome de Savoie. When I was traveling in France a couple years back, I love cheese. Like I've always loved cheese, but that's where things just were like, oh my God, because every meal, breakfast, lunch, dinner, out came the cheese trolley. And you're like, what are these cheese? What is this?
First off, a cheese trolley. What a wonderful trolley. You know?
I know. And I think it's like, you know, like that standard sort of like, you know, customary thing where like you're supposed to just order three cheeses or something.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I'm Canadian. And it was just like, the plate. It was like, I'll have some of this and I'll have some of this. And so I got to discover a lot of cheeses that I just wasn't familiar with. And one of the cheeses that I was like, oh man, this is like awesome was Tome de Savoie.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit more earthy, like semi-firm, earthy, mushroomy notes or whatever. So,
and also a fancy I was like, name oh, as well.
You know, this could be kind of tasty if we're having some Riesling and I should bring some cheese treats.
You know what's one way I realized just how you're getting older? When I was a kid, I was always sad for the people that were lactose intolerant because it meant they couldn't have ice cream.
I'm still sad about that as well.
I am sad about that as well. But then when you get into wine, then it's like, oh, because when I was 9, I never thought about cheese. I just thought of mint chocolate chip ice cream. But then, you know, when you get older and you get into wine and studying all that, then suddenly cheese is just as important as ice cream in terms of something that's part of the food groups.
Yeah, for sure.
Wine contests. I'm curious how many when was the last big one that you were involved with?
That was Bosque, which you were there.
Yep.
Won a nice little, bid on a nice little prize. I remember that from that evening.
Yes.
Stole the show.
Yeah.
There's not that many wine competitions. Oh. I mean, I think there's a lot more in the States. Like I know they have Psalms Under Fire and a bunch of other, competitions over there. Like I think here in Ontario, Bosque is the one that, I guess is,
and that's the best Ontario song.
Yeah. So the last time I actually had to get, like, you know, on a stage and perform in any way, shape, or form wasn't an exam scenario. Was for Bosque.
And how was that? How did you? Because that was a couple of years ago now. So I mean, I won't go into any of the specifics, but what is that like?
It's a bit different. I think It's way different in terms of what you would expect walking into an advanced exam.
Yeah.
Like when you go through an advanced exam, you're doing all of the same components. Like you are doing blind tasting, you are doing theory, you're doing service, but that's more of a, it's competition.
Yeah.
And so for, it's almost a little bit more, some things seem a little bit more like trivial. It's like trying to catch people and who can do this and who can do that. So having prepared for a few years, and in the process of preparing to do something like an advanced exam, which is very, you know, you're going to be asked to do very standard, that you know what's expected, standard specific things. You know what wines you need to understand and be able to blind taste, like in a deductive process. So walking into Bosque, the spectrum of what they were asking for theory was maybe a little bit, I don't want to say not conventional, because everything on there was really reasonable and fair to ask, but they're really kind of, you know, did you go here? Do you know this?
Yeah. It's a little bit more gotcha, would you say?
Yeah. The blind tasting is where I think it's a little trickier in the sense that they're throwing a lot of outliers in.
Oh, okay.
That maybe you're not used to.
Yeah. Like
blind tasting.
Like some sort of funky blend from Portugal.
Yeah. We had a Cananao from Sardinia, I think. And you're kind of like, you just aren't even thinking, you're not even on the radar of, oh, this is Grenache from Sardinia.
Oh,
and maybe like the one thing that I've really always got to give a lot of credit to the court for is they are not going to put a glass of wine in front of you that isn't like just the best representation of what that wine should be.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Which makes it easy in some respects. Like,
yeah, I mean, you know, you can get rid of certain, you can get rid of certain things. Yeah. You're not going to, as you just mentioned, the house Grenache from Sardinia is not going to be on not going to be on it, and nor should it be, because part of it is it's about service, and you know the wines that 98% of the time is what they can test, or you know around they can test you on, but the funky outliers, it's not going to be part of it.
So definitely, like what I've learned, it's a different form of prep to go into something like that.
Yeah,
you know, and then there's the whole fact that when you get, if you make it, you know, to nationals, you've got to do your service in a second language. Like I can barely do my service in my own first language, let alone trying to do it in Spanish or something.
Man, at least you get all the wine in the glass. I said on my first, the first podcast, I knew I failed the certified because I passed theory and I passed tasting. But then when the cheap Prosecco came, as much as it was going in the glass as out of the glass. Because I made the mistake of putting the glass in the wrong spot, and then and then that just started a chain reaction.
It's all about the recovery.
There was no recovery whatsoever. I just feel bad for whoever was cleaning the carpets that day. So the next question I want to ask you is a little bit more, not as fancy, but I want to do it as, and we talk about the wine. How often, and especially when you were younger and even now, do people get intimidated coming to your place if they're not in the industry, bringing over wine?
Bringing in their own wine?
Bringing in their own wine. You know, like you're having a dinner or you're going to someone's place for dinner. And then, because this happens to me all the time.
Okay, yeah.
And they sheepishly go, I hope this is okay.
Oh, yeah.
I always feel so bad.
That definitely doesn't happen in the restaurant. Like,
no.
I don't,
I'm talking in your home.
In my home?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. And like Christmas holidays. I feel like, it's more, I think I get it a little bit more with my family or like my non-wine friend. Actually, my non-wine friends are hilarious. They just make fun of me.
Yeah.
I mean, I described a wine as being approachable like 7 years ago or something, and I just haven't lived that down.
And they still done it? Really?
Oh my God. I got like one of my friends sent me a photo of like David Laurison's wine review from the LCBO when they were in there shopping, and they're like, look, Jules, David Laurison thinks this wine's approachable too. And I'm like, thank you.
My worst for that, wine tasting at the National Club, and I started to smell the glass, and it was the water glass.
Oh yeah, perfect.
And then I tried to put it down, but I'd gotten caught, and that happened like a decade ago, and it's still every now and then. Hey, look, Matt, and they swirl water. I'm like, yes, hilarious.
Well, the best is if you've had like for whatever reason, like when you're on a tour, like you're traveling, you're on an enrichment trip, or if you're doing judging, like I've judged in a couple of different competitions and whatnot, where all day, you know, you're tasting, you're spitting, and then you sit down for dinner and you're like looking for like, oh, where do I spit my wine? You're like, oh no, this is when I swallow the wine.
This is when I actually swallow it. Ooh.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd love to talk about judging, but let's try the second Riesling. And again, it's Germany. So the hardest part is the pronunciation. It's one that you're familiar with.
It's Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
Williner, Schoninger. All right. So in the Moselle Valley.
Yeah. I've always liked just the delicacy and just of what Moselle brings. And so when I went to the, actually the LCBO, boo on the LCBO, the one down Queens Quay.
Ooh, Queens Quay gets a boo, eh?
I love it. But their Riesling, their German Riesling section was a little bit light. But maybe it's...
Ebbs and flows.
Yeah, no, I know, I know. So
I have this problem with white Burgundy because I have a problem with white Burgundy. It's like, let's find the wine that I can't afford to drink and then develop an obsession.
It sucks. It sucks. Imagine, like, just imagine if $15 Pinot Grigio tasted like, you know, Premier Cru Merceau. Like how
I'd be wasted all the time.
Just every day. But you'd be saving money.
So much money. Yeah. It's not a bad thing, I guess, right? Like, you know, it's better for the liver. You can't necessarily afford to drink the wine you really want to drink.
It's true. It's true. So what do you get on those? And again, I just want to pick two reasons from two very different regions. One St. Catharines, one Moselle.
Yeah. So again, on the nose here, again, we're dealing with like a fairly medium plus to high intensity.
Mm-hmm.
I get a lot more ripe kind of developed fruit on this one. So where the fruit was maybe a little masked on the first bottle and you got a little bit more of the kind of chemical compounds coming out. This one I'm getting a little bit more golden peach and a little bit more ripe red apple, a little bit more fresh lime, some like brighter honeysuckle notes on the wine. Still get a little bit, again, of that like classic kind of petrol-y note. Little, even like a white button mushroom and like some dried straw or dried hay.
Would you get made fun of if you use dried hay with your friends?
My wine friends, no.
No, your non-wine friends.
Oh, I get made fun of for everything with them. Are you kidding me? They're like, you're such a douchebag, Jules. It's just wine.
What? Jules, why didn't you just say mushroom? Why did you have to go?
I wouldn't talk about a wine like that in front of them, though. I know. Like, no, I'm just going to shut up and drink it.
Yeah. It's so funny, just your drinking experience with your non-wine versus your wine
except
friends.
That they now all discovered how much they love sparkling wine.
Yeah.
Right?
And
so
they're
like,
thank for that.
So then you bring over like, you know, a nice bottle of bubbles or whatever. And it's like, ooh.
Yeah. You know. Like, make fun of me 1 second, but be really
it's
happy.
Like, oh, yeah. Now you don't have anything to say. Yeah.
I'm still debating, do I edit out the spinning? I'll go back. Or do I just leave it in and amplify the volume of it? I haven't decided yet.
Actually, that's kind of funny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. I'm going to play
heightened
around
slurpy notes.
Yeah.
So again, you have some pretty high levels of acidity here, but you don't notice it the way you did with the Featherstone because there's a little bit more residual sugar, a little bit more RS.
Yeah.
Which almost gives a bit of a softer feel. I remember when I first started... like training and blind tasting and studying wine, that was one thing that I always found a bit more challenging was really measuring the level of acidity in a wine that had a fair amount of residual sugar because of how it masks that.
Yeah, that is hard.
Yeah. And then you just have to like take almost a bit more of a moment to be like, okay, yep, nope, palate's still salivating. Really juicy again on the palate, even more so with the ripe, like peach, ripe apricot, ripe pear, red apples. Again, that pronounced kind of honeyed character to it. It's nice. It's juicy. Again, quite light, you know, light on the body, low in the alcohol.
That's under 10. Oh yeah. 7.5.
7.5, right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's, you know,
there's beer that has more alcohol than this.
Yeah, exactly.
The biggest thing is like you could drink it all day. The thing that's going to kill you the next day is not the alcohol, it's the RS. And you're just like pounding sugar headache.
Oh, yeah. It's so funny. Like, oh, I'm just going to drink bottles of this. Take that hangover. No, don't worry. Mm. Your body will find a way to punish you for what you've done.
It has a neat little like candle wax like note on the nose too. Like not so much in that petrol, but more of that paraffin wax or... Mm-hmm. Almost like a Vaseline, which I know I'm really selling today.
Mm-hmm.
Come try this delicious glass of Riesling that smells like Vaseline.
Yeah. Mm. Well, then it goes back to the classic, you know, manure, cat pee, you know, earth, barnyard, which are all wonderful things when in the proper context.
Yeah.
In the proper context.
No, nope, totally fair.
You should try it with a, thank you. I tried with
cheese. Was it good?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Of course. How could it be bad?
Yeah.
So, all right. I'm gonna put a lot of questions I want to ask you if you'll agree to do another podcast. Mm-hmm. But I want to, at the very least, ask about judging, because about judging right. wine competitions. What's that like? Do you feel guilty? Do you not want to look the people in the eye, the people that you're judging?
The thing about the judging contest is you don't know what's in your glass. And that's the best thing about it. Everything is okay. totally blind.
Yeah.
And it has to be totally blind. Yeah. Like it does. It's the only real fair way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have no idea what you're tasting. It'll be like, here's a flight of, you know, Merlots under $25, and you're just going through them and mm-hmm. trying to assess what's showing better. And it's the thing that's kind of neat about judging. It's kind of who's on the panel and who you're judging with, because you can be there, you know, from a somm standpoint, where you're really just sort of, you know, evaluating the structure and the consistency, and you're looking for quality markers for a wine. And then you can be on a judging panel with someone that's really techie, you know, that's like a winemaker or something, and they have all the technical, and they start sitting there talking about, well, like that, you know, it's all the technical terms of maybe what's happening with chemical reaction and X, Y, Z. And okay.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought to look at it like that. So it's interesting. Yeah. Like, but I mean, it's completely fair in the fact that you're not sitting there being like, oh, I know the person that made this wine and it sucks.
Yeah.
Oh. You're just looking for the merits in it. Right. But for me, you're really looking for markers of consistency and of balance and, you know, kind of, purity and quality in a wine and ageability in a wine. And it depends on the category as well. Right.
Mm-hmm. What's been any wines that stand out for you in terms of ones you've judged recently? They're like, oh, that was a really good wine. This is one I would recommend.
Oh my God, I think I almost have to pass on that because it's been it's been a while since I've judged. And,
yeah.
And you don't even find out sometimes.
Yeah.
It's not like you find out. You have to sit down and you have to sit and really go back and
really
go through, because some days you're judging 50 wines a day.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So you'll go and you'll taste the ones that. You go back and you know the ones that won and the ones that got the awards, and mm-hmm. you can see, but it's been a couple of years since I've done like a real hardcore sort of judging session. So
beyond white Burgundy, what, cause,
oh yeah. Oh, for sure.
Well, no, what do you really enjoy now? And it always changes, and it changes sometimes by the season, by what you try. I come from a sports background, so I love to rank my favorite regions, favorite grapes, and it changes all the time. Except for Baco Noir, you're the last, but everything else has its place. But for you, and apologies, Henry Appellum, you tried your best. You did. Your reserve Pinot Noir is great, and I should really like your reason. Your Pinot are great, but anyway, what's one you're really liking right now?
So classic response from a sommelier about a what are you drinking now wine question.
Yes.
So I mean. I find it really funny that people are like, oh, it's winter and it's cold, so I'm going to drink red wine, and it's summer and it's hot, I'm going to drink white wine and rosé.
Yeah.
I guess maybe I'm like a little off on that. I find I'm drinking a lot more white wine on a day-to-day. And I enjoy red wine. I drink it. But for me, it's something maybe more with a meal, especially as it gets a bit heavier.
Yeah.
I really gravitate towards high acid, like crisp, mineral whites, and then lighter, fresher, more ethereal style of reds for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like as I said, I mean, as most people say, like a delicious bottle of white Burgundy is always a treat.
Always is.
I like Riesling. I tend to gravitate to a bit more drier style of Riesling. I'm really liking Rieslings from Austria.
Mm-hmm.
They're just somewhere between, they still have enough, I think, of the generous, like kind of fruit to balance them out a little bit and not be that really like Clare Valley razor blades on your palate.
Yeah.
Style of Riesling.
Yeah.
And really mineral. I like Riesling, and I do like and enjoy off dry Riesling. I just don't find I can drink as much of it.
Yeah.
Despite being light, like the sweetness will build up a little bit on that.
Yeah.
Reds, I mean, lighter style reds, you know, like great Pinots or Gamays. Again, even some of the reds coming out of Austria, the Blaufränkisch and whatnot can be pretty tasty. But yeah, I'm like, I like to say I'm like an equal opportunity drinker.
No.
So yeah, no, I'll drink a little bit of everything. But if I'm having, oh, and like Syrah, obviously there's like all the time in the world for yep. Syrah if you're having something with a little bit of age. But to me, it's like I've gotten to a point a little bit, I find it really difficult to drink big reds that aren't ready.
Yeah.
Like,
oh yeah.
To have like a full glass. It's interesting to taste them and see how they can develop and where they can go. But like sometimes
you're
just murdering a baby and you're like, I can't drink this. Like, you know, like Nebbiolo is amazing, but you want it to have you want like 10 years on it. So it starts to soften
a little bit
and the floral and the aromatics come out.
Yeah. You want a little glint of brown and orange somewhere within the, you know, the color of that wine to really enjoy.
Yeah. You just
the
want
Nebbiolo.
Them to be expressive and to show, which is.
Well, Jules, thank you very much for doing this. Where can people find you? Social media? Like, where's the best spot?
Yeah, I mean,
you could like bleep it. No one find me at all.
No one find me at all. No. I mean, I'm on Instagram. Mm-hmm. You know, if you enjoy looking at, you know, the knob that just posts bottles of wine.
Yeah, your Chateau.
Oh, that was amazing.
God.
23 single vineyard.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I'm aware. I know. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm aware. As someone who posts douchebag pics, I saw that.
Moderated by the winemaker himself.
Yeah. That was a good day. That looked like that was a good day. That was a good day.
That was amazing.
All right. So where can they work?
At, you know, Jules Gartensom or Jay Gartensom or something like that on Instagram, Facebook. I don't really use Twitter. I don't really use like there's a hash. I don't even know what my domain would be for Twitter or whatever you call it. Or, you know, if it comes see me at the Oxley Public House or Wixon Social, I'm kind of float between the two of those.
Yeah.
If you just want to have a neat glass of wine, try something a little bit different.
The Oxley, fantastic in York. Wixon as well. I go to the Oxley more. Love the Oxley. Definitely one of my favorite bars. Thanks so much for doing this, Jules.
Thank you.
Everyone, thanks so much. That was the fifth episode of Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Wait, no, that was the sixth episode. And Jules, you wonder, do I edit anything from this? You're going to hear that mistake.
Okay.
Bye, everybody. Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.